Peter Schiff, Chairman of Schiff Gold, Chief Economist and Market Strategist for Euro-Pacific Asset Management. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for inviting me on.
So, Peter, we're speaking on Monday, February 2nd. Obviously, there's dramatic moves in the metals here recently. I think we obviously need to begin with that. Are you at all concerned about the 41% pullback in silver and 21% pullback in gold? And what are the nuances, do you think, that investors and even just people looking at the market, at the metals market in particular, need to understand about that?
Well, I mean, first of all, you have to understand just what happened prior to the drop, you know, how much the metals were up. So even though silver's way down, I mean, it's still $76. It's 50% above the double top from the all-time record high. So we still have a breakout in silver. Yes, gold's pulled back from over 5,500. It's now about 4,600. You know, but that was a record high a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the metals have still made a lot of progress. In fact, even though gold was down $500 on Friday, the last day of the month, it was still its best January ever, despite the decline. So, you know, keep it in perspective. But I also don't think the sell-off was a natural event. I think it was orchestrated. I think the Trump administration was behind it. I think a lot of his friends made a lot of money off of it, but I think it was a coordinated attempt to basically, you know, put out the fire from gold and silver, because I think gold and silver were basically warning that a dollar crisis was coming and a sovereign debt crisis. It was a real vote of no confidence in the administration, in the Fed. And I think they had to do something about that. So I think they coordinated the raid with the early release of Trump's Fed pick with false talking points to disseminate to the media that somehow this was some huge surprise and that Trump had decided to appoint a inflation hawk who will be much more hawkish than Powell and far less likely to cut rates. In fact, likely to start raising rates almost immediately, and less likely to use quantitative easing, more likely to resume quantitative tightening. That is the story that is being sold. And I don't buy it. I mean, I just think that's complete BS. But I think Trump was confronted with a situation that he needed to defuse. You know, the world was questioning Fed independence. They expected the next Fed chair to be a puppet of the administration. And it was based on that preparation, one of the reasons that you saw such weakness. Dollar hit four-year lows, all-time record low against the Swiss franc, record highs in gold and silver. So they had to do something to push back against that narrative. And this is what they coordinated. And but, you know, I don't think that's true. I don't expect a, you know, an inflation fighter. I expect, you know, a puppet. I don't think that Trump would have given Walsh the job if he really expected him, in his mind, to be worse than Powell, right? Because the reason he doesn't like Powell is because he hasn't cut rates enough. This guy, you know, may even raise rates the way he's being portrayed. And so I don't buy that. And maybe what they try to do is nominate somebody who looks like a independent choice, who's, you know, not going to just do what Trump wants, but who is a real inflation hawk. Then when he goes and cuts rates anyway and does exactly what Trump wants, they'll be able to pretend that this is independent. They'll say, look, you know, I appointed this hawk. You know, if he's cutting rates, it must be economically justified. I mean, there's no political pressure here, right? I didn't appoint one of my guys. I appointed somebody who is, you know, a hard money guy. And so I think that's part of the plan, right? To try to make it look like he's exercising his own judgment instead of just doing what Trump wants. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but at the end of the day, I think the momentum out of the dollar into gold and the silver is going to continue. It may be slowed down. In fact, it was slowed down by this, but it's not going to be stopped. The only question is how long will, you know, people be afraid to buy gold and silver because they're worried about this happening again. But it also is possible that now that we've got this big decline out of the way, people may feel more comfortable buying, thinking that, okay, it's already happened. Now I can step in. Obviously, buying silver at 76 is a lot more appealing than buying it at 126 or 121 where it got to. And, you know, buying gold at 4,600 is better than 5,600, you know?
Peter, what do you think about the, let's say, the other side of what is pointed at normally as a another, you know, piece of the decline, that the banks that hold these big short positions on, let's say, specifically silver, but also gold, do you think that that's, you know, a possibility of the coordination of that attack on the metals?
Yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, the shorts were in a lot of trouble, and now they're in less trouble, but probably because they now have an even bigger short position. So all this does is kick the can down the road. Doesn't solve the problem. It makes the problem worse. And, you know, again, but that's what Washington does. It's all about extend and pretend, right? It's not about solving problems, but preventing them from blowing up while you're on the job, right? So that's really what it's about. It's, you know, push it down, push it back. And so hopefully, according to Trump, you know, their goal is just to make sure the music doesn't stop until somebody else is president. Then he doesn't care, right? Because he could leave and say, hey, I did a great job. Look, this guy ruined it all. Right. So.
Right. Well, of course, there's always that finger pointing, no matter who gets that position. But, you know, as I was looking at this, the broader market here, one thing I wanted to ask you about is if you think that this was a bit of a larger margin call, and because a risk asset like Bitcoin sold off in the same time frame, does that make you question things any more because of that correlation in that time frame?
Well, I mean, Bitcoin was already selling off the whole time. Gold was going up, Bitcoin was going down. And then, you know, a lot of people expected that the money would rotate from gold and silver to Bitcoin, especially when we had that big drop in gold and silver on the Thursday, Friday. People expected, okay, the money's going to come into Bitcoin. Instead, Bitcoin had a big drop over the weekend. So not only did it not catch a bid from money leaving gold and silver, it got tanked too. And so, you know, I think the Bitcoin trade is likely over. I've always thought it was a bubble. The bubble obviously got much bigger than I had expected when I first recognized that it was a bubble. But the air is coming out. Most people don't recognize that. And, you know, I think that the main reason that the bubble got so big was gold went sideways for 12 years after it had moved up from under 300 to almost 2000. It, you know, consolidated. And that allowed the Bitcoin community to kind of get the gold community to move into Bitcoin as digital gold, because Bitcoin was going up and gold was going sideways. And so everybody in Bitcoin was making a bunch of money and people weren't making money in gold. But now that gold is rising, it's hard to convince people that they need some alternative, that Bitcoin is better, you know, because even though Bitcoin has delivered great returns, if you bought it 10, 15 years ago, it hasn't delivered good returns. If you bought it more recently, I mean, the best example is Michael Saylor himself, who is the biggest Bitcoin buyer. He's been buying it for over 50 years. He spent, you know, close to $55 billion buying Bitcoin. And his average price on all that Bitcoin is just over 76,000. And right now it's 79,000.
Right.
So he barely has a gain. He would have been better off just, you know, buying T-bills. He'd have more money. Now, the stock did better because he bought Bitcoin, because the fact that he was buying all this Bitcoin made people want to buy the stock. But the Bitcoin itself has been a lousy investment on its own, which should prove that all the hype was BS and the stock should come crashing down, because, you know, there is no actual benefit to MicroStrategy shareholders from owning all this Bitcoin. And the other problem is, of course, his meager gain is only on paper. If he actually tried to realize the gain by selling the Bitcoin, the price would collapse and he'd have huge losses. So he's in a very difficult position where he has a highly concentrated position that he can't sell. And I think that's why he keeps buying more, because it's his buying that is preventing an even bigger drop. But, well, you know, there's a limit to how long he can do that. You know, and now he keeps upping the money he's bribing the convertible preferreds, or, you know, to make believe that there's a viable instrument there. You know, they were, it was 10%, then it went to 11%. Now it's 11.25%. He keeps increasing what he's paying, despite the fact that they're losing more money.
And I was going to say, it would be interesting to try to understand what the actual Bitcoin price would be to this day without that injection of the $55 billion that he put in, right?
Yeah, well, I think suffice it to say, the price would be a lot lower without Strategy. And not just Strategy, but because Strategy initially had a lot of success, there's a lot of copycat companies that have also been buying Bitcoin. They're also way down on their Bitcoin, even more so than Strategy is, because they just started buying near the highs. So they're way underwater. But also the other thing that really helped pump up Bitcoin was Donald Trump. You know, his election interjected a lot of speculation into the market. A lot of people went out and bought Bitcoin because it now had the support of the Trump administration. In fact, not only did the Trump support Bitcoin, his family went all in on Bitcoin. They're like, they're running crypto businesses. So everybody believes that Donald Trump will pursue policies that favor crypto, that favor Bitcoin. And in fact, he's come out and said, I want to make America the Bitcoin capital of the world. And so people believe him. And so they want to own Bitcoin. Right? And this is a mistake, because it's not up to the government to decide that we should be the Bitcoin capital or the capital of anything. We should have a free market. Let investors decide. Let the returns generate capital flows. You don't want, you know, the heavy hand of the state, you know, tipping the scale in the favor of something, especially when they have a vested interest, like the Trump family does, in its success. So I think that really allowed a lot more speculative money to pile into crypto, which allowed a lot of the donors to the Trump campaign to sell, which is what their goal was, to basically get the government, not just the federal government, but then the state governments, to buy or talk about buying what they already owned so they can sell it at higher prices. And so, you know, what you have now is a bunch of bag holders that own an asset that's going to implode. And all of the money that was made by the early buyers is going to equal the money that's lost by everybody who's left holding the bag. And a lot of these bag holders don't even realize that they're holding the bag yet, because they haven't tried to sell. They're holding and they're hodlers, right? They're just riding it out, and they just assume it's going to a million. So they don't care. Well, they're in for a rude awakening.
Peter, you recently went to El Salvador, and that's a state that is, let's say, a bag holder from a public policy standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I just got back. I think I picked up something, because I'm not feeling well today. I think I picked up something, you know, down there. But you know, the one restaurant, you know, because I ate mainly at the conference, but one night I went out to dinner, and I jokingly, you know, asked the waitress, because I was eating with Anthony Pompliano and his brother, and I was like, when the waitress came, and I said, you know, do you take Bitcoin? She kind of laughed and then said no. So they wanted dollars. They didn't even want. So even in El Salvador, like, you know, they don't want Bitcoin. So it's a myth that, like, it's all running on Bitcoin. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was going to say, I appreciate you making time for the interview despite feeling terrible today. I wanted to thank you very much for that. Going back to Walsh and being the new Fed chair pick, does him being or does the weight or seniority of being the Fed chair matter more than the other 11 seats? And does he kind of direct the rest of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously he's just one vote. So in that respect, he doesn't have any more direct power than anybody else. But I think that the Fed chair has a lot of influence. So, you know, if he says, you know, we should hike or we should cut, and there's some other members that disagree, they may, if they're not sure, they're likely to defer to the chair. You know, after all, he's in charge, and he's supposed to be, you know, the best for the job, right? Because otherwise somebody else would have been picked, right? So he is the all-wise, all-knowing guy. And if he says something and somebody else says something else, I mean, the balance would tip in favor of the chair. Mm-hmm. So I think he does have a lot of influence over what happens. But, you know, there could be a dissent. But again, if the dissent is in the minority, it doesn't matter, right? You know, it's a majority rule, right? So, you know, there's 9 guys there. So you just need 5 to go one way. If four go the other way, you know, if nine guys say cut and four guys say hike, right? Diametrically opposed, not even neutral, right? There's a cut, right? So
do you think that the role of gold through the Fed's eyes has changed over the last 20 years, and especially, let's say, in the last 3 to 5 years with all the central bank
finance? Definitely changed from what the chair is willing to admit publicly, because you never know, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. And, you know, Jack Nicholson and a few good men, you know, I he's not telling the truth because he knows that the public can't handle the truth. And so the same might be true with Powell. But when Greenspan was Fed chair, he specifically said that he followed gold as his main indicator, you know, and it was a market mechanism to let him know if the decisions they were making were correct. So if the gold price was moving higher above 400, that told Greenspan that we're too loose and we need to tighten up. If gold went below 300, that would be the market saying you're too tight. You need to ease, right? And he said that this, in a way, was a de facto gold standard because gold was the barometer that he was using to guide him in his decisions. Now, Powell just said the other way, the Fed doesn't care about gold. Couldn't care less what happens to it. It's meaningless. Mm-hmm. And so the point I made on X is, well, who's right? Because they both had the job of Fed chair. So was Greenspan completely wrong? You know, or is Powell completely wrong? And, you know, I think Greenspan was correct. And the fact that gold was under 400 when Greenspan made that statement, and it's well over 4,000 now, over a 10x increase, that would suggest that interest rates have been too low, that the Fed has been too easy the entire time, according to Greenspan. And I agree. You know, the gold price is telling you that. The Fed should be reacting to it. They should be tightening, but they won't do it because they know that, you know, our over-leveraged economy can't handle it. You know, when Volcker, you know, raised short-term rates to 20%, it wasn't that he did it because he thought that would be good, that everybody would like that. He knew that it was bitter medicine that needed to be swallowed. And we had the worst recession since the Great Depression as a result of those high interest rates. But I think the problem now is the Fed realizes that if we swallow that medicine now, it'll kill us. You know, we'll die from the medicine. So we may as well die from the disease because that's going to be later.
Right.
And so I think that's what's going on.
What are some of the other indicators, economic indicators, do you think that are pointing out the, let's say, acuteness of this disease at this point?
Well, I think the most important one is the run-up in gold and silver, right? I mean, that's why it's happening. Mm-hmm. But also the weakness in the dollar. I mean, it's not pernicious yet, but the dollar dropped to a four-year low before, you know, Trump announced Walsh and everybody pretended he was a hawk. The dollar hit an all-time record low against the Swiss franc. So it's never been that low. Swiss franc is another, you know, canary in the coal mine. Long-term interest rates, the Fed has already lost control. Long-term interest rates are higher now than they were before the Fed started cutting rates. Even if you go back to the first rate cut, they've cut rates six times and long-term rates have gone up. That's not what they wanted. So the bond market is not cooperating. So that's already a sign that there's a problem because the market is recognizing that, you know, we're not good for the money, that we're not going to be able to repay our debt without massive inflation, which doesn't count as repayment. It's basically a surreptitious way of defaulting. And if you're a creditor of ours, you don't want an inflationary default. You want to just get out, right? You want to do something else. So you're going to buy, you know, you're going to buy gold instead of treasuries. And that's what they've been doing.
Well, you and I have spoken before about basically the bond market signal being wrong for two investors. Do you think that this is actually turning around now?
Well, not totally. I mean, and Powell bases his confidence on the bond market. So the reason he's so dismissive of the warning that's being sent by gold and silver is because he says, look, we're not seeing it in the bond market, right? We're not seeing it in inflation expectations that would manifest themselves in higher yields. And he's missing the point that yields are higher than they otherwise would have been absent these fears building. But I think Powell is wrong to assume that because we're not seeing a wholesale run on the bond market, that that's not around the corner. That the gold market and now the silver market are just more sensitive to that loss of confidence. But the next domino that's going to fall is going to be the bond market and the U.S. dollar relative to fiat currencies, not just relative to gold. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you can't wait for that. I mean, if you wait for it to get that bad, again, what are you going to do about it, right? If you don't heed the warning that gold is sending and you just continue, you know, going over, you know, towards the edge of a cliff, you're going to go over the cliff. And by then it's too late to say, yeah, well, I guess there was a warning there. You know, it's like, all right, well, now what are you going to do? Because it's a full-blown dollar crisis. It's a full-blown sovereign debt crisis. But that's where we're heading. And I think some people in the government might know that. I think their primary goal is just to delay the crisis. They don't want to stop it. They don't even want to lessen it. They just want to delay it. That's their primary goal. Don't let it happen on our watch. First, the goal is to get through the midterms, you know, and then just get through the election, right?
Peter, what do you think that crash or that crisis looks like? Is that a, you know, a flash crash, very dramatic, big upset that doesn't get recovered for, you know, maybe a decade, maybe more? Is it a long grinding affair that just, you know, systemically constantly breaks one thing after another?
I don't know. Slower? I mean, a lot of it depends on how we react to it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're going to see it as a consumer. You're going to see it in that prices are going to go way up. I mean, much more than everything we've seen. And it's not just that prices are going to go way up. I mean, a lot of things are just not going to be there. The shelves will be empty. Mm-hmm. You know, we may have rolling power blackouts. There may be price controls. There will be a substantial increase in unemployment. You know, the markets will be weak. You know, it's going to feel very bad. I mean, it's going to be worse than anything any living American has ever encountered as far as an economic downturn. I mean, you'd have to go back to the Great Depression, but this could easily be worse, you know.
Do you think that consumer confidence is starting to really roll over despite, you know, record cheap gasoline prices, and are those going to last?
No, I mean, I think consumer confidence is already rolling over. I mean, people dismiss the fact that it dropped to like a 14-year low last week. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the main things that, you know, consumers have to be thankful for is that gas prices are lower. But I don't believe that that is a permanent situation. In fact, oil is already up about 20% so far this year, you know, and it's just about 1 month. So it's very likely that oil has already bottomed and will keep rising. And so we've already seen the low in gas prices. And so if Trump was this unpopular with cheap gas, how much more unpopular is going to be when gas becomes expensive like everything else? Mm-hmm.
So in that response to a crisis, Peter, do you think that that's, let's say, the real catalyst point that begins a more hyperinflationary cycle than we've already seen basically since COVID, or the inflation since COVID?
Well, you know, if the dollar is falling, then, you know, you're going to see the inflation much more dramatically than when it was rising. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we import so much. And so that's an immediate impact. And it also has a more bigger impact on commodity prices. And that's why if you look at copper hitting record highs, you know, other base metals, look at agricultural commodities, I mean, across the board, that's why producer prices, I mean, look at them year over year, they're up 4%, mm-hmm. double the Fed's 2% target and headed higher. And producer prices are a leading indicator of consumer prices because first the producer prices rise and then the producer responds by increasing his prices to cover the rising costs, right? That's the kind of the order that prices increase. They move through the supply chain. But ultimately, everything is absorbed by the end buyer, the consumer.
As you mentioned the idea that you know, commodities are at such elevated levels here, do you think that mining stocks are still far cheaper than they otherwise would be? And why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think that the investment community does not understand what's happening in the precious metals. And they think that this is a bubble, and probably what just happened in the last couple of days validates that. And so they don't think the high prices are sustainable. And so they're not willing to attribute a big increase in earnings, future earnings, to these mining companies if they don't believe these high prices will last. I think they're wrong. In fact, not only do I expect the high prices to stay, but I expect them to go even higher. And so I think the markets are completely wrong in their assessment of what these companies are going to earn in the future. And so their present price is, you know, a huge bargain. So I think the people that understand why Wall Street has got this wrong are buying. You know, most people don't understand that. That's why the prices are so low. Most people, you know, buy into that idea that this is some kind of bubble. And so they're not willing to pay up for these stocks. And as a result, the people who understand it can get a great price that they otherwise would not be able to take advantage of if more people recognize the truth.
Trying to step back and understand, let's say, the next leg of this market, Peter, do you think that this sell-off creates a perfect buying opportunity for those that were maybe, you know, sitting on the sidelines waiting to get in? And does this next leg of the metals and miners market really bring in a lot more of Main Street, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great opportunity for the physical buyers. You know, I don't know where the bottom is, but I also can see that the premiums are widening. So to actually buy gold and silver coins, let's say for me at Shift Gold, those coins have not come down by the same amount as the silver, because demand has actually moved up in the physical market. More people want to buy these lower prices, but we don't have the supply. So the premiums on physical are widening, the gap between the value of the melt value and what you have to pay. And I expect that to continue to widen in the physical world. But, you know, I don't know where the bottom is for paper gold, but prices have come down quite a bit. I'm not saying that, you know, the prices are the same as they were when silver was 120. They're much lower, but the percentage decline is less than what you've seen in the futures market. Because when you're buying in the futures market, you're not actually getting any silver. You're buying from a guy who has no silver. Right. So it's just a paper claim on nothing. So in the real world, you do have an opportunity to take advantage of what's happening in the make-believe world of futures speculation. I don't know where the bottom is, though. So you can't just say, oh, I'm going to buy silver when it's 78. And what if it goes to 70? Right? What if it goes to 65? I don't know. Maybe it won't. Maybe this is the bottom today. I don't know. I'm not smart enough to know that. Mm-hmm. But I do know that people were buying silver at $120 last week. And now you have a chance to buy it for $79, or not quite, but 83, 84, whatever the premium is. I think it's something that you take advantage of. Mm-hmm. You know, because I don't think the prices that we saw, everybody is saying, oh, that's like another blow off, like 1980, like 2019 or 2020. I don't think the circumstances of this rally are anything like those prior rallies, you know, where silver, you know, stopped where it had a lot of overhead resistance. We have blown through the overhead resistance. So it's the charts are very different now than they were back then. And the fundamentals are far better now than they were back then. So I don't think it's another situation of like the Hunt brothers cornering the silver market, where silver went from a dollar to 50. We haven't seen anywhere near a 50x move in the price of silver. So I think we got a long ways to go. This is just a speed bump here. It's a big bump, but you know, it's not going to stop the train.
Sorry, everyone, to cut off the interview there. Peter had to go. If anybody wants to see more of his content, that's all available at europac.com, shiftradio.com, as he is the host of Shift Radio, and of course on X at Peter Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F. Please don't forget to like and subscribe, even comment on the Competent Man channels, please. It helps me get better guests for the show and helps the show grow. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed the show.